Hello. And in this session, we're going to talk about the presuppositions of NLP. Quite a key area, and there are lots of kind of debate and discussion around what the presuppositions of NLP actually are in terms of their specific names, if you like. They're often called convenient assumptions, and I think they're actually a lot more than convenient assumptions. I think the presuppositions of NLP are assumptions that we make, but they're actually the beliefs that we need to hold. And if you remember this model from earlier in the course, we said that perception, the way that we think, our mind affects our beliefs. Beliefs determine values, beliefs and values determine behavior, and behavior gets results. And the whole thing becomes a complete loop. So depending on what beliefs you hold, that's going to affect the way that you behave, that what's important to you in terms of how you behave as well. And so obviously that's going to affect your results. Now, for me, the thing about the presuppositions of NLP is that these are the underpinning beliefs that help us behave in a way that gets the results that we're looking for through using NLP. So if you believe all of these presuppositions, then at an unconscious level, you're going to be hold the right sort of values. You're going to be behaving in a way that is going to make your NLP tools and techniques and your processes much more effective. So you're going to get better results. Now, there are lots of kind of, as I say, there are lots of debate about what the presuppositions actually are. And like the whole field of NLP, it's constantly changing and being updated. And, you know, as Robert Diltz said, anything that works is NLP. So NLP is constantly bringing new things in. And depending on who you talk to and which books you read, the presuppositions will be, there'll be different numbers of them. I've seen anything up to 23 of the presuppositions. I prefer to work on 14. So there are 14 presuppositions that I think are core to understanding NLP, but more importantly than that, making it easier for us to use the tools and techniques of NLP and be effective and get the real results that we're looking for. So fundamentally, if you believe all of these, it's all going to work really well. If you don't believe them, or you find it difficult to believe some of them, if you act as if you believe them, so you behave consciously in a way that reinforces those beliefs, you'll still get the good results. But like we said earlier on in the course, the difficulty with being conscious about your behavior is that when you find yourself under pressure, you revert back to your old behavior because nothing's changed at an unconscious level. So we're going to go through the presuppositions of NLP here, and I want you to spend some time thinking about them. There are a lot, so this is quite a long session, but it's split into obvious sections. So there are 14 presuppositions. We're going to go through each of those in turn and have a quick kind of explanation of what I think the presuppositions are all about. So here we go. So the first one I want to talk about is the importance of having respect for the other person's model of the world. Now, this doesn't mean to say that you have to agree with the person's view of the world or that you have to buy into it, but just that you have the respect that that other person has a right to have their own understanding of the world around them, just as you've got the right to understand the world from your point of view. And the important thing about this is that having respect for it means that it's going to affect the way that you behave. So as are all of these presuppositions. So if you believe that it's important to have respect for the other person's map of the world, then you're probably going to spend a lot more time listening to other people, taking their viewpoint into account before you make your own decision. So as somebody said, seek first to understand. So understand the other person's point of view before you put your point of view forward. So this is going to make you more accepting of other people's views. And as I say, it doesn't mean to say that you have to believe them or agree with them. You can be really fundamentally in disagreement with their map of the world, but you have to respect that they have a right to their map of the world, just as you've got a right to your map of the world. Next, evaluate behavior and change in terms of context and ecology. So in terms of context and ecology, we'll take those two things separately. First of all, in terms of context. So if you evaluate behavior and change in terms of context, This is something that we do naturally anyway. We make judgments about people's behavior. And what I'm suggesting here is that we should look at their behavior and think about the context that that's in. So, for example, if I was to pull a gun out in a crowded pub and shoot somebody, that probably wouldn't be acceptable. Not in the UK anyway. On the other hand, if I was to shoot an intruder in my house, would that be acceptable? Well, that's a much greyer area legally, and there have been some key cases in the UK that sort of explain and debate about whether this is fully acceptable or not, and whether that is justified as reasonable force. But if I'm in the military, I'm in a war zone, and somebody steps out from behind a car with a gun, points the gun at me, and I shoot them, is that acceptable? Well, probably more so. I mean, it depends on the terms of engagement. But the reality is here that this is the same behavior, but in a different context. So we need to evaluate somebody's behavior in the context before we make a judgment on it. And the same with change. Is change acceptable in every context? Do we want to have that change in every area of our lives, or is it just about one area of our life? So if we're thinking of implementing change, we need to think about the knock-on effects of that, which brings us on to ecology. Because in these terms, ecology is about the impact your behavior has on somebody else. We can't not interact with somebody else. So everything that we do, every change to our behavior that we make is going to have an impact on the people around us. It's going to ripple out from us. And so before we put a change in place, we need to evaluate the effects of that change on the people around us. And that helps us to decide whether we want the full change or a part of it or some of it. Similarly with behavior, in terms of evaluating people's behavior and the effect it has on people around them. And it may be that their behavior is actually okay. It's not having an effect. You might not like it, but it's not really having a detrimental effect on anybody. So maybe then we can just let them get on with it. So if you believe that this is true, this is going to make you step back from a situation and analyze and think a little bit more before you make a judgment and before you behave and interact and react to that situation. The next presupposition we want to look at is resistance in a client is a sign of a lack of rapport. So if you believe this is true, then what are you going to do? Well, the chances are you're going to be more flexible with your approach. If you're getting resistance from somebody you're talking to, somebody you're trying to influence in whatever way, and then what we need to do is to make sure we build more rapport and really focus on having rapport with that individual. Because the belief goes on to say that there are no resistant clients, only inflexible communicators. Now, if you believe this is true, then you're more likely to try and find a different approach, to build some more rapport, to find a different approach, to use that flexibility, which is, of course, one of the key processes of NLP. So people are not their behaviors. Well, people aren't their behaviors. We've only got to look at the diagram, the belief systems loop, to show that, you know, perception, mind, beliefs, values and behaviors. We need to separate the behavior from the beliefs and the values. And we talked about this earlier on by saying that, you know, some people, some managers who are very autocratic and very aggressive are behaving that way. They might be nice people. They might be caring. They might be really generous people. They behave in that way because they believe that that's the way they should behave as a manager. So separating people from their behaviors can help us deal with people in a much more effective way, in a much less judgmental way. Even just talking to our children and saying, you know, you're a really naughty boy. They're not. They've done something that's bad. And my daughter uses an approach and has done ever since her daughter was born of that's not good behavior. And it's focusing on the behavior, not on the child. And the same with adults. You know, if we think about it from a disciplinary point of view at work, it's really about separating that behavior from the individual. And even on a bigger scale, when we think about how we treat criminals, in the country, where, you know, if we separate people from their behavior, if we stop calling people a murderer or a burglar or a robber or a rapist or whatever, and look at the behavior, then there's more scope for helping people change that behavior because we accept the person. So people are not their behaviors. Accept the person, change the behavior. Next, everyone is doing the best they can with the resources they have available. Everyone's doing the best they can with the resources they have available. So if people aren't doing very well, you know, as a manager, if people in your team aren't doing very well, if you believe that people are doing the best they can with the resources they have available, what are you going to do to get better performance out of them? Yeah, we need to look at resources. We need to increase the resources that they have. So that may be resources in terms of time or money or equipment or power or whatever that may be, but it's also resources in terms of skills. So we need to think about how we can increase people's resources. So if we believe that everyone's doing the best they can with the resources they have available, then that means that we're more likely to look at them in a positive light, understand what's going on for them, help them develop the skills, give them the equipment, or whatever it is that they need to be able to do better. Next, we have calibrate on behavior. Because the behavior is the only information you have of the person you're talking to. You don't really know what's going on in their minds, so you've only got their behavior as an illustration, an external manifestation of what they're thinking about or how they're feeling or whatever. So we need to calibrate on behavior. And what that means is we need to be able to understand what people's body language, tone of voice, words, because all of that is behavior, what that links back to. And the only way we can do that is to not generalize. So we're not talking about reading body language books here. What we're talking about is understanding what that behavior means for that person that we're talking to. Because that's not only the most important information we have, it's the only information we have. And the better we are at calibrating people's body language and their behavior, the more accurately we can understand what's going on for them internally. So this means we need to take time to understand the person we're talking to. We need to understand the link between certain facial expressions and emotions, which means we've got to spend a lot more time discussing, talking, watching the two, calibrating that behavior. Next, we have the map is not the territory. So what is a map? Well, a map is a two-dimensional representation of a three-dimensional reality. So the map itself is not the territory. It's a representation of the territory. So this is all about the idea of perception and reality. This is about how we take information in and make sense of it and represent it in our own minds. Because not just about the real territory out there in terms of the roads and the hills and the mountains and so on. This is also about the understanding of the world around us and our own lives. Because what do you use a map for? Well, you use a map to navigate your way from A to B, or to look at a territory and understand what goes where and how it all fits together. And so we create a map inside our heads, because we can't go to Smith's and buy a map of life. We have to create our own. And some of us are better at drawing than others. Some of our maps are more accurate in terms of the way we represent the reality than others. So the map is not only the territory, but the map isn't the real map. It's our understanding of it. It's our perception. So what we need to do here, if we believe this is true, then whatever perception we have about the world around us, we check it out. So it's one of the things that I keep recommending to people around social media is when you see a post on social media that creates an emotional response, check it out, fact check it. Look on the websites that do these kind of things and make sure that what's been put in front of you is accurate or not accurate, and understand it from that point of view. But that's not just about social media. That's about everything that you react to. It's about checking what's going on and whether it's real or not, and how closely aligned is the reality and the perception. And if you believe this is true, then you're going to be a lot more thoughtful about the way you react to situations, and it will take you time to step back to kind of think about the reality. Next, you're in charge of your mind and therefore your results. You are in charge of your mind and therefore your results. Because if you aren't, who is? So the good news about this is that if you're in charge of your mind and therefore the results you get, remember the belief systems loop we talked about earlier, the good news is that everything that you've succeeded in, everything that's worked well for you so far in your life, is down to you. So well done. Of course, there's a flip side to that as well, which is that everything that you haven't succeeded in and got the results that you were looking for is also down to you. So the important thing about this is about personal responsibility. This is about saying, if you believe this is about saying, well, this is down to me. What do I need to do differently next time to get the results that I'm looking for? And it links into, you know, one or two of the other presuppositions of NLP, one that we're going to talk about in a minute, but also, you know, the idea of resources. So you're doing the best you can with the resources that you've got, as well as it being down to you whether you've succeeded or you haven't succeeded. I know there are external pressures on us to achieve what we want to achieve, but essentially what we're saying is that, you know, you're in charge of your mind and therefore your results. Nobody else is in charge of your mind. That's all down to you. Next, people have all the resources they need to succeed and to achieve their desired outcomes. People have all the resources they need to succeed and to achieve their desired outcomes. Now, on the face of it, this might seem to be a little more complicated, if you like. But the reality is that we're not saying that everybody's got all the resources at hand. What we're saying is they've got the resources to be able to get what they need. So, for example, if I wanted to be a long distance lorry driver, I might say, well, I can't do that because I can't drive a lorry, so I'm never going to get that job. But I can drive a car. So I've got some resources I need to be able to achieve it. If I can learn to drive a car, I can learn to transfer those skills into a lorry. So what we're saying here is that we've got all the resources we need to be able to achieve what we want to achieve. So there are no unresourceful people. There are only unresourceful states. And you may find yourself in an unresourceful state, which makes it difficult for you to imagine a way forward, to work towards achieving the goal and succeeding in what you want to achieve. And you might also look at that and think, well, okay, so what about people with disabilities? What about people who've lost arms or legs or whatever? And, you know, if you look at that, then there are people who've climbed Everest with no legs. There are all sorts of people who are overcome all kinds of obstacles to achieve what they want to achieve. And if you're a little bit uncertain about the overall meaning of that presupposition, then maybe if you said they're realistic goals, would that make you feel a little better about it? So people have all the resources they need to be able to achieve, to succeed and achieve their realistic goals. But there are no unresourceful people. There are only unresourceful states. So if you have some resources in the sense that you know how to learn, so you can learn something new, you can develop the skills that you need to achieve the goals, you can change your states to become more resourceful, which means that you're much more likely to be resilient and bounce back from difficulties along that route. And if you believe this is true, then you're probably going to work harder towards achieving a goal because you believe that you've got the resources you need to achieve it. Next, all procedures should increase wholeness. All procedures should increase wholeness. Well, there's a couple of things there we need to really clarify, you know, in the sense of what is procedure and what is wholeness. And so if we think about a procedure, essentially that's a description of a way of doing something. So it's about how you describe A to B to achieve something that you want to achieve. And you'll have procedures at work to do all kinds of activities. So procedures is really about everything that we do. So what about wholeness? What's wholeness? Well, I look at wholeness as being us becoming the person that we can be. So achieving our perfection, if you like. So being the best person that we could be. So what we're saying here is that everything that we do should be aimed at increasing wholeness, of becoming the person that we can be, realizing our potential. And, you know, as a belief, this is quite important because it helps you with decision making. Because it's sitting there and saying, well, will this job help me become the person I can be? Will it help me realize my potential? Is it a step on the path towards that? And if the answer is no, then you've got to ask yourself, why am I doing it? There may be a short-term game in terms of money or whatever that may be, but the reality is we need to kind of step back and think about our lives in that broader sense and think, what about the balance here? What is it that I'm doing, and how is it helping me become better, become the person that I can be? And of course, this links into having all the resources you need and lots of the other presuppositions. They're all interlinked quite closely. So next we have, there is only feedback. There is no failure, only feedback. And this is, on the surface, quite a difficult one to think about, because we might look on things as being failures. So, you know, I failed my driving test, I've failed my GCSE. But the reality is that the result is the same, the outcome is the same. We haven't got the marks we needed to be able to gain a driving license. But if we look on that as a failure, failure has an emotional impact on us that feedback doesn't, because feedback is kind of neutral. We think about it, we can think about it as being really positive. It doesn't have that emotional connection that failure does. So if we take the word failure out and put feedback in, then we're more likely to carry on doing it again, because if we feel like we failed, it's a lot harder to motivate yourself to have another go at it than if you think, right, okay, now I know that I haven't past it, but I know what I need to do differently next time. This is about learning rather than beating yourself up. So the classic example of this is Edison and the light bulb. And when he was attempting to make a light bulb and hundreds of attempts that hadn't worked, and somebody said to him, well, you know, why do you keep going? Why haven't you given up? You know, there's hundreds of attempts. He said, I now know hundreds of ways of how not to make a light bulb. So if we look on experience as a learning experience, you might have heard the phrase, every day is a school day, then we're going to be much more positive about the situations that we take. And as somebody said, what would we attempt if we knew we could not fail? Well, if we believe we can't fail, we're going to attempt all sorts of things. And then, of course, if we're not getting to where we want to be, we've then got to realize that we have got all the resources we need. We're just in a non-resourceful state. So thinking about the fact that this isn't a failure, it's just feedback, and learning from that feedback can be a really powerful way to try things you haven't tried before, to push yourself forwards, to look for goals and help yourself achieve those goals much more effectively. Next, we have the meaning of your communication is the response you get. So the meaning of your communication is the response you get from somebody else. So regardless of what it was you wanted to achieve with your communication, what this is saying is that, again, this is about personal responsibility. This is about you taking responsibility for your communication and making sure that people get the message you want them to have rather than the one that they get. So it's saying that, really, you know, whatever I say to you, whatever meaning you get from it, that's what I meant when I told you. So if I believe this is true, then what it will make me do is think more carefully about the way that I communicate to you to make sure that I get the response that I'm looking for rather than a completely different response. So believing that the meaning of my communication is a response that I get means that I'm going to be far more careful in making that communication and thinking about and planning and preparing more about how I'm going to do that. So next we have the law of requisite variety, which doesn't really mean much in itself because we need to understand what the behaviors are behind that. But really, the law of requisite variety states that the person with the most flexibility will control the system or will control the interaction. So we'll get the best results. And remember what we said earlier on about, you know, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail because it has to. So the more tools you've got in your toolbox and the more you're likely to use them, the more effective you're going to be. I know we'll have our favorite tools that we try and use most of the time, but if you believe that the person with the most flexibility is going to be in control and is likely to get their result rather than your result, then that's going to mean you're going to be more flexible. You're going to look at the situation, you're going to plan more effectively for it, and then you're going to listen to yourself, listen to the conversation, watch the calibrate on behavior, all the things that we've talked about here, build rapport, and know that there's no such thing as failure, there's only feedback, which means you'll try a different approach. And if that doesn't work, you'll try a different one. Because remember, you've got all the resources you need to achieve the outcome that you're looking for. And finally, all procedures should be designed to increase choice. So again, we've got procedures here. So everything that you do essentially should be designed to increase choice. Another way of looking at this, and the way I think of it, is that choice is better than no choice. And the effect that having no choice has on you and your emotional state is quite powerful, because if you believe you've got no choice, that's one of the things that causes stress, because of that feeling of being out of control is very stressful. But if you can take choice back, then you're going to be less stressful. And as we know, we make better decisions when we're not stressed or not as stressed as when we're really stressed. So there is, of course, a problem with too much choice. I know I've walked into supermarkets in the past for a pasta sauce, and there's been a whole aisle full of pasta sauces, and I found it really difficult to choose. And when my daughter was really young, and we'd go into a shop and say, you know, choose a sweet, she just couldn't do it. There was too much choice for her. But again, that's better in lots of ways than having no choice at all. So what we're suggesting here is that if you believe that all procedures should be designed to increase choice, or at least the perception of choice, that's important. Because if we're trying to sell an idea or a product or a service to somebody, we need them to understand that they've got some choices around what they choose, about what they decide to buy or buy into if it's an idea or an approach. So choice is much better than no choice, and everything that we do should be designed to increase that choice. So there we are. 14 presuppositions of NLP. The great thing about them being in sections is that you can stop and pause and think about each one before you move on, or you can go back over them again, of course, and think about those. The important thing about these is that they are core beliefs, core beliefs and values that help us to be much more effective in the way that we use NLP, but also from that point of view, much more effective in the way that we influence other people, the way that we can improve our own performance as well as other people's. So if you can believe them all, fantastic. If you do believe them all, well, that's brilliant. There might be some that you've got a bit of debate about, so spend some time thinking about these. But if you do have a debate about them and you don't believe them, then, as I said earlier, if you behave as if you believe them, you're still going to get the same results, because behavior gets results. So whether that behavior is conscious, so you're choosing to behave as if the map is not the territory, or you're choosing to behave as if you have respect for the other person's map of the world, you will still get the results that you're looking for. But if you can believe these, then that's much more effective, because the change has happened at an unconscious level, so it's permanent. So that belief change will affect your values and affect your behavior naturally without having to think about it. And that's a great place to be. And so the more you think about these presuppositions of NLP, the more you kind of think about certain situations and how you've behaved and whether they're aligned with the presuppositions of NLP or not, the more likely that is to become an unconscious process and will affect your behavior without you really thinking about it. And that's a good place to be.